This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A candidate answers the question, do Democrats need a billionaire of their own to beat Governor Bruce Rauner in next year's election?
If they need a really rich guy, I'm not the guy. If you're looking for a billionaire, I'm not your guy. If you're looking for a millionaire, I'm not your guy.
Democratic candidate for Governor Daniel Biss talks to GLT's Ryan Denham about where he stands and his middle-class credentials. School starts soon. Some parents are already buying school supplies. Others are trying to figure out how to afford those supplies. Charlie Schlenker talks with the chair of the Back to School Alliance. And Laura Kennedy and our own culture maven talk about a female Doctor Who. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's July 28th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Democratic candidate for governor Daniel Biss says Governor Rauner is trying to turn the dispute over school funding into another Chicago versus downstate fight. The state senator from Evanston was in Bloomington Normal yesterday, where he picked up Mayor Terry Renner's endorsement. Speaking during an interview with GLT's Ryan Denham, Biss talks about his campaign for governor, starting with the fight over school funding.
Well, what I think will happen is that we'll figure out some kind of deal. Right now, Bruce Rauner has decided he's going to veto Senate Bill 1, even though he himself said he likes 90% of it. I mean, the guy just doesn't understand how democracy works. I believe him. I take him at his word. I think he'll veto it. I think the Senate is likely to have the votes to override. The House is less likely. And if we're unsuccessful in overriding the veto in the both houses, then we'll have to go back and figure another way forward. And we will. I don't think anyone's prepared to see schools not open in the fall, and so I would assume that cooler heads will prevail. But listen, what we really need is a comprehensive fix to our broken school funding system, the most unfair school funding system of any state in the union. Senate Bill 1 is a small step in the right direction, and it's important, and I support it, but we need a more comprehensive fix, a fix that says, listen, we have property taxes that are too high, that overburden middle-class families. Our income tax is unfair. We ask too much of the middle class and not enough of the very rich. We need to transform those systems and build a modern school funding formula that works for districts across the state of Illinois.
So you tweeted out a picture this week marking up some of the comments that Governor Rauner made on NSB 1. Basically, you look like you marked it up with red pen like a teacher or professor might do. Yourself, you're a former math professor, I believe. You asked Governor Rauner to show his work as he's talking about some of the math behind the conclusions he was drawing. What kind of feedback did you get on that? Why'd you do that?
Well, I did that because Governor Rauner is embarrassing himself. I mean, Governor Rauner can't explain what he doesn't like about Senate Bill 1. He even says that he likes 90% of it. But for political reasons, because he wants to drive a wedge in the middle of Illinois, because he's scared of what happens if people across the state of Illinois who are suffering under his leadership unite together to fight for a better government, because of that, he's decided to call this bill a Chicago bailout. And it's just dishonest. And it's dishonest and it's destructive to the state to see our governor pitting one region against the other. And I wanted to point that out in a way that was kind of lighthearted. And it's true, I used to be a math professor. I spent a lot of time with red pens marking up papers, and the skill came back to me pretty fast.
As you said, you taught math at the University of Chicago. You attended MIT and Harvard. So you've seen higher education at its best. So why do you think Illinois has pulled back so much in terms of its investment in higher education in the last several years? And what do you want to do to improve support for state universities and more importantly, the students at those universities?
Yeah, let's be clear. Illinois still has higher education at its best. Illinois State University is a great institution. So is the U of I. So are other public institutions in Illinois. So we are capable of producing higher education at its best, but that is supposed to be produced by a real partnership between the institutions themselves and the state. And the state has just walked back on that bargain and has walked away from higher education, walked away from universities, walked away from community colleges, and walked away from tuition assistance to help young people afford school. And it's, let me be honest, Ryan, it's insane. It is just utterly destroying our long-term economic viability. And so we need to do the exact opposite. We need to invest more in higher education. We need to make sure we bring tuition down so that everybody can afford higher education, not just people who happen to come from affluent families. We need to fund MAP grants properly. We need to do these things to ensure that our public higher education system is actually public, is actually accessible to the entire public, and thrives and continues to be part of the best of the higher education system. We just haven't done that, and it's shameful. And by the way, while places like ISU and the U of I continue to be stellar examples of just what a university can be, the harm that this budget nightmare has done to some other public institutions is devastating. They've been harmed. They've been diminished. They've lost faculty. They've lost enrollment. Because they've lost enrollment, they lost tuition funding as well as state funding, and they're risking going into a downward spiral. That's just unacceptable.
You support a constitutional amendment to create a progressive income tax in Illinois. I guess what would that mean? Can you help our listeners understand what that means exactly?
You bet. Illinois is one of only four states in the union whose constitution says we have to have a flat income tax. So our tax rate right now is 4.95%. You pay 4.95% if you make $20 million. You make it if you pay $20,000. Bruce Rauner, who made $188 million in 2015, he paid that same rate as someone making $18,000. And that doesn't feel right to most of us. It also isn't how most states do their tax code. If you go to a place like Wisconsin, people over $365,000 a year, they pay 7.65%. But people under can pay less. And so what I'm saying is, in an environment where, listen, for decades, almost all the new money in the economy has gone to the very top, we got to go after that money to balance our budget. We shouldn't be saying to middle-class people who have not gotten a raise for decades, you're the person whose taxes we're going to raise. We should be saying to the people who have been getting enormous raises year after year that they're where the money should be gotten from. And if we were to do that, we could have a tax system that was lower on the middle class, lower on the working poor, only asked the very richest residents to pay more, and still brought in more revenue, and all while doing it in a way that's similar to other states around us. It's not radical. It's not unusual. It's very common sense and normal. It's just something that we can't do in Illinois, because when our Constitution got written in 1970, very wealthy people and special interests conspired to stick this in there. It was a mistake then. It's a big mistake now. We have to fix it.
Well, something else that might impact our state budget, not necessarily why you advocate for it, but you've co-sponsored a bill in the past that would fully legalize marijuana in the state of Illinois. Why do you support that?
Three reasons. Number one, if you look around the state and frankly around the country, our marijuana laws are not being applied equally. If you're an affluent white kid from the Chicago suburbs and you're caught with a joint, you're usually given a slap on the wrist, if that. But if you're a poor kid, poor African-American kid, poor Latino kid, white kid in a community of poverty, the treatment you get is totally different. That's wrong. That's wrong. And we can't allow that unfair system that criminalizes poverty and criminalizes people for being black and brown. We can't allow that to continue. And so for that reason of racial and social justice, we need to legalize marijuana. But it's not just that. I would also say that, you know, I think some people who want to legalize marijuana say that they want to legalize it because they think it's totally fine, it's no big deal, it's no problem. I actually disagree. I think there is a public health problem associated with drug use, and the way we've been handling it has not worked. We've got to treat this public health problem as a public health problem and find public health solutions, not criminal solutions. And finally, to your question, listen, the state of Illinois needs money. The state of Illinois government needs money badly. If we could legalize and tax the use of recreational marijuana, that would help our budget, and we could use the help.
I'm here with State Senator Daniel Biss, a Democrat from Evanston who's running for governor. So let's pivot to the election itself. The primary is in March. You have some very wealthy primary opponents. If Democrats want to win and they want to beat Governor Rauner, who himself is very, very wealthy, don't they need a really rich guy to do it? And why are you the right guy for this?
Well, listen, if they need a really rich guy, I'm not the guy. If you're looking for a billionaire, I'm not your guy. If you're looking for a millionaire, I'm not your guy. I live an ordinary middle-class life. And if that's what the Democratic Party thinks we can't handle anymore, if we can't have middle-class candidates who live normal lives in office, then you better vote for somebody else. But I just don't think that's where we are right now. I think the people of Illinois, on both sides of the aisle, see that we have a government that's not been working for the rest of us. And when you put a billionaire in office who has not lived a normal life, I don't think it's all that surprising that he then governs in a way as though he doesn't really care about people who live normal lives. I think the people of Illinois understand that if we want a government that works for the rest of us, we need a campaign that we're all going to own together by investing in small contributions, by pitching in time and volunteering together and organizing in our own communities on behalf of our own neighborhoods. I think that's what this moment demands. And I don't think Democrats will benefit in the long term by saying, oh, you got a billionaire, that's cool, we'll find our own billionaire. Because guess what? Democrats are going to run out of billionaires first. Democrats are going to run out of billionaires first. If we want to be successful in the long term, we need to use people power, not billionaire power.
So before you run against Governor Rauner, you have a primary to win. So how do you balance that message to make sure you're not putting the cart before the horse and running against Governor Rauner too soon before you actually, you know, win the primary in March? How do you balance your tone, your messaging, all that?
Well, listen, Governor Rauner has failed, and I talk about that every day because it's important and people are hurting across Illinois because of it. But I also think the Democratic Party has an important choice to make. And we have to choose, are we just going to be against Governor Rauner, or are we going to be for an aspirational vision for what we can do to lift people up across the state of Illinois with progressive policies? Are we going to be a billionaire party, or are we going to be a middle-class party? Are we going to be a corporations party, or are we going to be a people's party? Are we going to have an election, or are we going to have an auction? And I think that choice is fundamental for the state of Illinois and for the Democratic Party. And I think if we get that right, it will also best position us to take on Bruce Rauner and win in November.
So if you were to do that, if you were to take on Governor Rauner and you were to win next November, how do you go about rebuilding Illinois' reputation nationally? I get a national paper delivered at home, and I mean, I've seen us on the front page of that paper about our budget crisis and how bad we look, frankly. How do you even begin to do that?
Wouldn't it be nice if Illinois made the front page of national papers for a good reason? Wouldn't that be a change? You know, listen, I don't want to pretend it's going to be quick. There's a big hole to dig out of, and there's a lot of affirmative work to be done after we dig out of that hole to achieve what the state government can achieve. But I think there's some basic steps. For one thing, I think it's important to run on a clear platform. Here are the things I want to do to improve people's lives across Illinois. And then after you win, you got to do it. Because what people in Illinois have come to assume is that we can't trust the politicians and nothing they say matters. And that leads to a downward spiral of cynicism. If you not only run on a clear agenda, but then work to enact it and improve people's lives with it, that helps build trust. I also think it's very important to run a campaign that includes people. Part of that's about funding the campaign with small donations from people across the state, but also part of that's about who you reach out to for help and how you organize. Earlier today, as Mayor Renner endorsed my campaign, I was standing with dozens of people from Bloomington Normal. These are not people who are elected officials or, you know, machine politicians. They're not the super rich. They're just people in the community who I've gotten to know during the course of this campaign, who I've formed a connection and a bond with, and now they are working in this community on behalf of our campaign. We've handed the keys over to these folks because we know that we'll be successful in the election by empowering people in their communities, and then we'll be successful in raising the reputation of Illinois if we govern based upon understanding what communities need and want and then going and doing it, as opposed to listening to a couple donors or a few special interests or a machine politician or two.
Senator Bass, we asked our Facebook fans here at GLT about some questions they'd have for you if they could be sitting in the studio with us today, and we have a couple good ones here I want to share with you.
Great.
So this one is from James Pancrazio. How would a Biss administration deal with the economic, political, and cultural divide between rural, downstate Illinois, and Chicago?
Yeah, thank you, James. I get that question every single day because we have fallen into this ugly trap of dividing Illinois, of pitting people in McLean County against people in Cook County. And you know what? I don't live in McLean County, but my life is better if McLean County schools are properly funded. That's important to me. And frankly, I think life in McLean County will be better if schools in Chicago are funded too. We are all in this together, and people, get this, people are hurting across the state of Illinois, across the state of Illinois. Yes, here in Bloomington, in Normal. Yes, in Chicago. Yes, in the southern tip of Illinois. Yes, in the far western tip of Illinois. People are hurting, and they're hurting because our policies have been written by a few very rich people for a few very rich people. So my goal is to travel across the state and not point fingers and not do demagoguing, but instead say everywhere we all need to rise up together. And I know that's a hard message to sell when the other side is just going downstate and blaming Chicago and going to Chicago and blaming the suburbs and going to suburbs and blaming downstate. But I think it's doable. I think people are hungry to be united. I think people are hungry to have a vision of a state that works for the rest of us, and that's the vision that I'm trying to advance.
So one last question from our Facebook fans. This one comes from Stephanie Stone. How do you feel about term limits, both for leadership and just traditional lawmakers in Springfield?
Well, one of the first things I did when I was elected is I put in a constitutional amendment to create term limits for leaders, to say that you can't be Speaker of the House or Senate President or Minority Leader of the House or Senate for more than 10 years. And the reason I did that is you got someone like Mike Madigan. He's been serving as Speaker since 1983. He's gotten more and more power. Every year he cuts more deals and more people own favors and he winds up more powerful. And yet all this time he's only accountable to the voters of his district. That's less than 1% of the state. That's not right. That's not right. So I strongly support that form of term limits. I also support term limits for the governor, by the way. I think an executive can become too powerful if they serve for too long. I support those term limits.
That's Daniel Biss, a state senator from Evanston who's running for governor as a Democrat. The primary will be next March. Thanks for coming in, Senator Biss.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
That's GLT's Ryan Denham. You can watch a video of Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner endorsing Senator Biss during his visit yesterday at our website, WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, a collaboration between Advocate Broman and OSF St. Joseph Medical Centers, providing cancer care, education, and prevention services at 407 East Vernon in Normal. One hope, one mission, one community. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's not long now until the start of school. Moms and dads in Bloomington Normal are picking up school supplies, shopping for new clothes, and getting those doctor visits in to make sure the kids have their immunizations. It's also a time to think about low-income families and the difficulties they have in preparing for the school year. Jan Meadows is a retired teacher and chair of the Back to School Alliance, which collects and distributes school supplies. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Meadows says the Alliance is a huge effort to support children.
It's really become a year-round project for us. We put together 3,000 backpacks totally on donations of supplies and money and shop when everything's on sale, so a lot of it's last minute as we're trying to get the best bargains we can. And we have close to 300 volunteers that participate in this year-round. We have students at Field that are developmentally disabled who help us pack during the school year. That's part of their work-study program, so they're over there busy. Our ISU students are here during preview donating supplies, and then in August they come to the welcome event on the quad, and they help us pack there, too.
What goes into each of those 3,000 backpacks?
Oh, gosh. Every one of them has, every grade level has a different supply list. Kindergarten, obviously, being the least and the lightest backpack that we have to carry around. All the way up through eighth grade, we don't have a vehicle yet for high school. We're still looking for opportunities to expand into that arena. We just don't have a funding mechanism to supply the backpacks that the high schoolers are in need of.
So these 3,000 is for K through 8, K through 9?
K what? Through 8. Okay. K through 8.
How big a percentage of the entire student body is that?
Well, unfortunately, it's barely half of students who are eligible in public schools in Bloomington Normal to receive those. If we were to service the number of students that are eligible, which is one out of every three public school student in Bloomington Normal, we would need closer to 6,000 to 7,000 to meet that need.
Describe eligibility so that listeners know exactly how rough it is for some of these kids.
Well, eligibility is based on the federal free and reduced lunch program provided by the district. That's where we get our information. They send out invitations to families that meet that criteria. But we have additional criteria, and that is that they have to have their immunizations and physicals that are required, and that they have to be registered at school. We have a lot of students who show up a week or two after school starts expecting to walk right in. And we found that by having this before the kids are going back to school and requiring that, that number has dramatically decreased, which was one of our goals, getting kids the first day started and ready.
It's a win-win then.
Absolutely.
It helps the school start on time, helps the kids start learning on time, and fills a need. How much of a need does it fill? What do these kids benefit from by having this bunch of supplies early on?
You know, it's one of those, there's a lot of research out there. There are certainly studies that indicate, you know, having the appropriate school supplies, leads to some success factors, confidence, fitting in, being part of the group, you know, building that classroom community that every teacher strives to build in his or her classroom. As a first grade teacher, I can tell you there's nothing sadder to have a couple of kids without anything. And as everybody else is pulling out, you know, all these, you know, shiny scissors and markers, and we always refer to the box of crayons. I said, everybody remembers that experience when you open up in grade school, that brand new box of crayons with the pointy tips. It has a smell, and it has a feeling, you know, and everybody recognizes that.
What do the kids look like, though, when they don't have those, when they, those kids who as you say...
Mm-hmm. It's hard to describe that. Anywhere from a chin up to with some defiance that once again... they feel like they're being put on display, to just abject sorrow, you know, of they don't have those things. And, you know, I think every, you know, teacher, especially of the young grades, has those extra supplies in his or her desk drawer. I cannot tell you how much money over 37 years I spent on school supplies for other children. But you have those in the, you know, in the back of your mind that you're going to whip those out. It's not the same as coming in with them. It fixes the immediate problem, but it doesn't fix... that feeling of not being, you know, on level playing ground, which we all want.
You say that there is no funding mechanism for the high school years. What do high schoolers typically need, and what is the need there?
Well, we supply the high schools with what we call the leftovers, which is when people very kindly donate three subject notebooks, which the younger kids don't use, and you know, really fancy things, spiral notebooks, some packs of paper, and we donate those to all of the high schools. So they have, you know, some of that, but what they don't have are the backpacks. And we, backpacks, we wrote a grant last year and we were so thrilled. We got a grant from Illinois Prairie Community Foundation to buy backpacks. So we gave 60 backpacks to Normal Community, Normal West, and Bloomington High School. And by the end of December, those were all handed out and gone. And we have no money to replace those, and we didn't get that grant this year. So, you know, high school backpacks, near and dear to our hearts, because, you know, again, because they don't have a supply list, they come in and the teacher says, and oh, by the way, for history, you need a red folder. And for art, you need colored pencils. It's all individual as to what the teachers are requesting that first day of class. So we just think we get the loose supplies there and then realizing how badly they need those backpacks. And, you know, as we've gone to this, you know, one-to-one, you know,
computer initiative.
Yeah. So they need a computer case, which, you know, they're very expensive to buy, or a padded backpack would also help to take care of that. So not only do we need backpacks that are large sized for the high school, they also have to be that extra padding for the computers, and those get very pricey.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Jan Meadows of the Back to School Alliance. How long have you been doing this?
Well, this is my sixth year. I retired 6 years ago. I said I walked in to take pictures, and I walked out leading the bunch. So don't ever take your camera to an event unless you're planning to assume some responsibility for that event.
Failures to duck.
Yes.
Okay. What have you seen as a metric of growth or diminishment of the need over that period?
Well, I'm very sorry to say that when I first started, our demographic reports were saying that one out of every four children in public schools fell at that poverty range, and it's now one out of every three. And I'm very surprised by that because, you know, living in this community, I don't know that I've visually seen that many more people, you know, that are in need, but they're there. We collect donations at Walmart, and we do that at both the East Side Walmart and the West Side Walmart. And we certainly see a lot of people who come to the party. They also donate as they walk by, and they go in and buy supplies and come out and donate them back to us and say, "We use your service," one mom said this past weekend. And I thought, I hadn't really thought of this as a service before, but in reality, that is. And she said, "And I've got some money now," she said, "so I'm going to donate." I'm thinking, you know, that's that whole building of community, that while you may not have that for all three of your children, you have enough right now to share. So I don't know. An awful lot of the people who come to the Coliseum now, the Grossinger
Grossinger
Center Arena. We always are shocked every year at how many people are coming in with minimum wage job shirts on. So we have our families coming in, and
the fast food restaurants or the gas station, or well, we're sort of backing into this, but tell us about the distribution and how you arrange for this party every year, and when is it?
Wow. It's August 8th coming up. When I first started this, we used to start the distribution at 5 o'clock because we believed that was the time we could get enough volunteers to come and hand those out. But that meant our families were standing outside. Some of them are arriving at 6 and 7 a.m. to stand in line to get these materials for their children.
At 5 p.m.?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we backed that up to 4 to 3, and this year we're going to be able to start at noon. We found we had the volunteers and the support to move that up and to get people out of the sun. I mean, that's a long time to stand. And you've got families that need to come with the kids and a parent. So we have whole families out there. And
do you run out?
Well, where's the knock on wood here? In my tenure, we have never run out. But I understand there was a year, several years back, where they did. And I think we probably lost confidence of people saying, because we had run out.
So they're lining up.
And they're lining up. And we say, you do not need to line up. We have enough. And we've not run out since then. So,
how long can people donate?
Boy, I'll take them at the loading dock door on the day of, and we're always looking ahead to next year as well. So we pack the bags out at the McLean County Community Action Center on West Washington, and around the back there's a loading dock door and a big parking lot, and we will be in there the week before the event all day, every day, packing, and people will just drive up, we don't even know who they are, and drop off, you know, bags of supplies that they've gone out and purchased.
You had talked earlier about the sense of community exhibited by that one mother who had enough for now and decided to donate as she was coming out of Walmart. How important is that in what you do and how it builds?
Well, that's certainly my that's my heart right there. I found it would be a lot easier if we didn't do that and if we just collected money and bought it ourselves and packaged it. It would be far easier. But that's not who we are, not who we want to be. So we try to have a very public face. This year, for the first time, we've connected with Hy-Vee. We're very excited about that. So the 2 weeks prior to the event, they will have collection boxes right at the front of the store. So if you buy something anywhere and you want to drop it off, a convenient place to do that. We are always looking for a place that's convenient for people to drop things off. And every year we try something new and we just keep reaching out. But very, very important to me, again, every friendly face that, you know, our families see, especially from the school system, we added a photo booth, so to say, a black panel with some balloons on it that we asked the principals to take pictures with their students as they came through. Positive interaction before school started. Oh, the kids were overjoyed to see them. And the principals participated so well. I mean, they're right down there, those smiles. And we have a lot of families that didn't have positive experiences at school. So to see their principals, to see people, you know, in the system, you know, again, building, you know, you may never have, you know, come in through my door before, but now you've seen my face and I've seen yours and we shook hands and, you know, you're welcome back. So there's a whole lot of things we're doing that, you know, keep building that community because I think that's what keeps kids safe.
Jan Meadows of the Back to School Alliance, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Distribution of backpacks and school supplies begins at noon on August 8th at Grossinger Arena in downtown Bloomington. You can see a list of school supplies for various grades at backtoschoolalliance.org and on Facebook. Jan Meadows says they will take any kind of school supply. It's Sound Ideas. Ahead, get to know Mongolian Death Worm and hear how progressive rock has influenced that band. John Norton talks with the founder of the band before it records a live show at Six Strings August 4th. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The world's most famous time traveler is about to undergo a change that for some is shocking and disturbing. Laura Kennedy has more.
Coming soon to a TARDIS near you, it's a brand new Doctor Who. And freaking out fans worldwide is the fact that, for the very first time, the Time Lord will be played by a woman. And by freaking out, I mean reactions ranging from elated to furious that English actress Jodie Whittaker will be the 13th Doctor. For over 50 years, the title character in this popular British sci-fi series has always been a man. Casting a woman is a historic moment for the series and its fans, most of whom took to social media to express their delight or displeasure with the move. Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven, says this moment has been a long time coming, especially since the show is science fiction, a genre which is speculative.
We're talking about a genre in which the craziest things happen, not the least of which that the main character regenerates and appears as a different actor or in a different body every few years and has for the last, what is it, almost 50 years? And then suddenly there's a freak out that it's a woman when you sort of think, well, that should have happened a long time ago, or can't they even imagine something beyond the binarism of male versus female in this speculative universe? So it shows you, the biggest thing it shows us is how utterly entrenched our notions of gender and what is gender appropriate are, that we are still, 2017, so easily shaken or put off by anything perceived of as a switcheroo.
So why were so many fans horrified by this?
Besides just sort of the regular sexist thing, this is our territory, keep the girls out, but we don't want to really say that we have a clubhouse that says no girls allowed, but really we do have a clubhouse that says no girls allowed. Aside from that, fans in general get very attached to how things are and to the details of things as they know them. And this kind of switch, any kind of major shift, is one that is likely to bring on lots of comment, good or bad. Every time there's a new doctor, there's an outcry, right? Peter Capaldi, fabulous Peter Capaldi. Oh my God, what are they doing? They're going to kill the series. Matt Smith, who's he? So the getting head up about the new doctor is really part of the culture of the fandom of Doctor Who. Because there's been a gender switch, a lot of it is focused on the gender of the new doctor. But I think that energy of challenging the decision, worrying about whether their precious series is going to go off in a different direction with a new doctor, is something that is actually just part of the fan culture of Doctor Who.
Well, I remember when Matt Smith was the Doctor, and before mm-hmm. him we had David Tennant playing the Doctor. Two very young, handsome guys. Mm-hmm. It seemed like the Doctor was just getting younger and younger and younger with each new regeneration. And I was like, what are they going to hire next? A zygote? It just
exactly.
kept getting younger. And then my niece is a big fan of Doctor Who and would watch this. And then Peter Capaldi got the role. And my reaction was, ooh, yeah, you know, middle-aged woman, I'm glad to see a middle-aged guy up there. My niece was horrified. She says, he's too old. Just as you say, there is this ownership of, well, that's not my doctor.
Exactly. And most fans that I know have their favorite doctor. And that's not just about the kinds of stories that happened during that period. And it's not just about what age they were when a certain doctor came in, but, you know, each of them have sort of an idea of what the right doctor is, and one actor or another fits into that. Just to pick up on the age thing, I myself am actually more disappointed that they went to a young actress. I was hopeful with some of the discussions that were coming up, floating people like Fiona Shaw and Joanna Lumley. And
Helena Bonham Carter would have been good.
Helena Bonham Carter would be fabulous in anything that she did. But the idea that because the Doctor Who figure is so malleable in terms of age, that I thought this was a great opportunity for a middle-aged or older actress. And we know that that's really the lost category in cinema and TV. But I think one of the terrific things about this casting is that Doctor Who has this great capacity for taking these actors who are not that well known, and the actors then just fly with this opportunity.
Well, I think that just makes it even easier for the show to cast somebody that people don't necessarily know. As a fan, as a viewer, you can invest more into that character because you don't have the baggage of some previous roles that they carry with them.
It's true, but the one, isn't this curious, right? Because the one thing that Whitaker is known for is Broadchurch, which was
wildly popular.
Wildly popular in the UK and in the US. And in that, she is the suffering mother of a child who's been murdered. To whatever extent there are any presumptions that accrue to her as an actress because of the roles that she's played in the past, way different from the kind of energy that we're used to in terms of a doctor.
Do you feel, Sherry, that Doctor Who, the show Doctor Who, explores gender identity in unique ways?
I think there are some other science fiction franchises that do it better or differently. It's been peppered there through the series, and particularly since Stephen Moffat came on, that is something that he's messed around with here or there. And in this last season, having the companion be a lesbian, there's been some play with that, I think, particularly in these last few Doctors. Also, doing what the genre does best. I mean, the science fiction genre does two things better than about any other genre. A, it plays with toys really well, and B, it imagines things that push our imagination into two places, because the genre changes the laws of physics. So time, for instance, is not a constant or a curve. It's a wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey thing. That's what science fiction does well. So, of course, science fiction ought to also play with this notion we have of there only being two genders and what each of those genders do as being set somehow biologically. Stephen Moffat has intended to have a female doctor pretty much since the get-go. And so I think you can see over the last couple of seasons, particularly under Capaldi, that Moffat has been working towards setting things up for the doctor to be a woman.
Of course, ratings are at an all-time low for this reboot of Doctor Who. Maybe they think, hey, we don't have anything to lose at this point. Or maybe they think, hey, this is a great way to bring ratings back up by doing something a little controversial.
I think it will bring ratings up, at least initially. This has been Stephen Moffat's agenda all along.
Sherry, this might be a bit out there, but do you see having a woman Doctor Who, could it possibly be a boost to STEM and drawing more girls towards STEM?
One of the things that I would say is generally true about these futuristic sci-fi shows is that they can generate an interest in science. Some connection there in what we embrace in terms of our popular culture also can change what we want to do in our real lives. Certainly the interest in forensics went up with the various CSI TV shows. One of the things that is a little different about Doctor Who is that he has a sonic screwdriver.
I love the sonic screwdriver.
I kind of love the sonic screwdriver too, but one of the things I love about it is that it has a name, like a familiar object. Of course, it does other things. So it has this do-it-yourself kind of imaginative quality. Take a police box and make it a time travel machine. Take a screwdriver and make it have all these other properties. That degree to which some of the objects and some of the technology in Doctor Who is not completely removed from our own experience does make a kind of more direct connection to what a real person might do. So, yes, having the girl wield the sonic screwdriver could make more little girls pick up a screwdriver out of the toolkit and pretend that they can do magic things with it, and that can lead to, later on, a more serious interest in science and gadgetry and fixing things and figuring things out and how things work and those sorts of things. Because how we imagine is absolutely key to how we end up living. So that's why these popular artifacts, such as TV shows and films and stuff, really are important. And that's why gender and racial diversity are significant in terms of how our future really is going to look.
That's Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven. She confesses that her favorite Doctor Who was Matt Smith. I'm Laura Kennedy.
As for paychecks, the Time Lords are equal. Actress Jodie Whittaker will reportedly be paid the same as current Doctor Who, Peter Capaldi. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. Find this story and all of the stories on today's show from Ryan Denham, Charlie Schlenker, and Laura Kennedy at WGLT.org. Ahead, John Norton talks with a founding member of the band Mongolian Deathworm. You're listening to the theme to Doctor Who.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
I'm Mike McCurdy. The funky, blues-inflected trio Mongolian Deathworm returns to Six Strings in downtown Bloomington August 4th. The Bloomington-based group will also be recording that night for a future CD release. Band founder Jay Allen Balmer joined GLT's John Norton in the GLT studio to talk about the roots of the band and how the progressive rock of the late 60s influenced his musical vision.
Centipede Thrombosis,
yes,
is the name of this song. It was recorded at Fat Jack's in downtown Bloomington. Jay Balmer, the song itself is a great title.
Thanks.
Let's get to the name of the band. I want to get right to it. Mongolian Deathworm.
Yes.
How does that symbolize what you're doing as a band? How does that name symbolize that?
Well, it doesn't symbolize it so much as it begs the question, who are we and what kind of music do we play? So one of the things that a number of venues, particularly venues that we've played in Champaign, always liked about the name is it forced people to call them up and say, what kind of music is it? But it started out as a joke. My old band was on hiatus at the time. I was researching, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it had to be something along the lines of urban myths. And one of the sidebars of the research that I was doing brought up this Mongolian Deathworm, which is actually based to some extent on fact. There are some rather large, hefty worms in the Mongolian desert. Yeah,
but it is a fictional thing.
Yes, okay. Yes. You know, I made a comment about it on social media, and a friend of mine, because I've always been really good at band names, said, well, you have to name your next band Mongolian Deathworm. And I laughed and said, okay, because at the time, I was in a band that had its roots that went all the way back to the 60s and figure I'm not going to be in another band until after I die.
Okay.
So I said, sure. A few months later, the old band was on hiatus, so I was, you know, looking to do something, and I was doing some solo acoustic stuff. Todd Asper, my current drummer, walked into that gig and said, I want to play with you. So we put together this trio with another friend of ours who's a really good guitar player but was originally a bass player.
Is this Michael Hill now?
Michael Hill is a bass player now. At that time, it was Doug Johnson.
Okay, all right.
So this friend reminded me that I said I would name my next band Mongolian Deathworm. So I figured, well, okay, I'll do that. We'll play one gig as Mongolian Deathworm, and I'll change the name. Well, it stuck. As a matter of fact, a few months later, my old band, we were getting together to play an annual event, and they called me up 2 weeks before the gig and said, we want to play under the new name.
Okay.
5 or 6 years later, we're now Mongolian Deathworm. For all practical purposes, that's who we are.
Centipede Thrombosis is the name of the song you're hearing. It's by Mongolian Deathworm. The band founder, guitar player, vocalist Jay Balmer is in studio with us. So, I mean, even the song titles sort of harken back to a progressive rock, progressive blues, all that era back in the late 1960s, early 1970s. You're really drawn to this music. Is this what you grew up on?
Oh, yeah. Well, both Michael and I grew up on the south side of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Blues is pretty well ingrained in who we are as people, but at the period of time we were growing up, it was actually the birth of rock and roll as we know it, and particularly fusion and prog rock. For instance, most of what we do is original. Even the covers we do, we tend to make them our own. But you know, we'll do some Emerson, Lake and Palmer. We do some Jimmy. We do some Jeff Beck. We have a samba that devolves into.
Really?
Yes.
Did you see my eyebrows move on that one?
Yeah. It's a samba, and then at the end of the samba part, Todd does a drum solo, and it evolves into a fusion song by that was originally done by Billy Cobham called Stratus.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot of different versions of Stratus out there, but, you know, so we still do that kind of stuff. Todd was in a number of prog bands in Champaign before he moved back here, and that's kind of how we met. We were at the original opening of the Envy Ultra Lounge in downtown.
Oh, yeah,
Marble.
Harry Fuller's
yep.
place, okay.
And it was the inaugural event. We wound up, my old band wound up being the headliner. And all day long, Harry was talking about stick around for the Captain Beyond band or the King Crimson band because he knew that that's what we were going to be playing.
Okay.
And so when we got there, Todd's other band was playing right before us. And as we were switching equipment off the stage, they said, well, are you really going to play that kind of stuff? I said, yeah, stick around. And they wound up being our biggest fans, standing next to the stage screaming every time we played a King Crimson song or Captain Beyond or something like that. So that band did a lot of different stuff. Actually, almost every band I've ever been in does a lot of different stuff. And if you listen to our originals, you'll see that there's probably five or six different genres. I mean, sometimes we'll play more than one genre in the same song.
Mongolian Deathworm is the name of the band. Jay Ballmer is the band leader. He's in studio with us. I'm John Norton. This is GLT Sound Ideas. You grew up in basically, what, the 60s, 50s, 60s?
Yeah, I was born in 53.
Okay, so you really came of age then.
Oh, yeah.
When this music was blossoming. It was an interesting time. Well, I was a little bit younger than you. Not a ton, but a little bit younger than you. So I kind of missed this whole era of when all the bands were open to all these different kinds of musics. The radio station, it was a short period of time, progressive rock radio, mm-hmm. probably especially in Chicago, where they were incorporating all these sounds and even venues. Bill Graham's Fillmore West would book like, Muddy Waters and mm-hmm. Charles Mingus and maybe Jefferson Airplane, on the same venue at the same time.
Exactly.
That must have been an exciting time to be really learning music. And,
oh, yeah. I mean... When we were in grammar school and early high school, we used to stay up late because there was a couple of indie radio stations that came on after 10 o'clock at night that used to play that kind of stuff. Mm. And there were places in Chicago like the Aragon Ballroom, and you'd see seven bands maybe in one night. One time the headliner was the Kinks. Right before them was Dr. John when he was doing his Night Tripper days. Mm. Prior to that was two of the original members of Yes who had a band called Flash. Bloodwind Pig was there.
Oh, my.
And a couple other bands. So it was everywhere.
So how did that influence you as a musician then? This is all... Joe Louis Walker, the blues guitarist, we've had this conversation a couple of times how all this music came together. So as probably like a 16, 17-year-old kid, it had to have influenced you to keep an open mind about the kind of music that you wanted to play.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I listened to everything back then. I had a vinyl copy of Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto that Van Cliburn played to win the Tchaikovsky competition. And I actually wore out three copies of that. I would listen to Grieg and all kinds of different stuff there besides the stuff that was coming on right then. You know, when Prague came out, the first King Crimson album, we probably listened to that six times in a row, and every time we listened to it, we heard something different. Mm-hmm. And that was what intrigued us. And then when we started seeing those bands performing, it was just, I mean, that's what we wanted to do. Back in the late 60s, particularly the early 70s, that's what we were doing. We were doing a lot of different stuff, but even back then it was trending more to the progressive stuff.
When We got time for one more song. Do you want to close with Open?
Oh,
I'm sure
yes.
You have fun with that, don't
oh,
you?
Yeah.
All the time.
It's really funny because.
By the way, the name of the song is Open. That's what right. I mean by that. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jay.
And we always end a set with that as kind of a joke, but also because it's a very dynamic song. We want to leave people wanting more, so that when we come back from break, you know, they haven't left because, you know, they were tired of what they were hearing.
Jay Ballmer, great to catch up with you, and congratulations on the music. An album coming out soon?
We're still working on that. The Fat Jack's gig was a live recording. We're going to do it again on August 4th at Six Strings, and we're going to take the best versions of all of our original music, and we may throw in a couple of the covers that people expect us to do whenever we play out. We actually have enough material for two CDs, so it'll probably come out as a two CD debut.
Jay Allen Ballmer, founder of the Bloomington-based prog rock band Mongolian Deathworm, speaking with GLT's John Norton. Mongolian Deathworm is at Starved Rock State Park Lodge. Tomorrow, the group returns to Six Strings in downtown Bloomington, August 4th. Find this story along with the full show podcast at WGLT.org. Our website is where you can also find contact information to email individual reporters or let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. You can also share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLTFM. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.